to Psalm 99 in our Bible study. All right, so we'll start with our summary for Psalm 99. Psalm 99 praises Yahweh for the holiness of his reign in Zion. I'll go over that one more time. Psalm 99 praises Yahweh for the holiness of his reign in Zion. All right, simple outline for the psalm, two parts, verses 1 to 5, the Lord's throne and footstool. Verses 6 to 9, the Lord's holy hill. Let me go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 5, the Lord's throne and footstool. Verses 6 to 9, the Lord's holy hill. All right, so let's go to our observations. Psalm 99 has no superscription. Jewish tradition attributed it to David, as is pretty much common for all psalms that don't have a author in the heading. This psalm doesn't have the direct connections to 1 Chronicles chapter 16, like in Psalm 95 and in Psalm 96 that we talked about those previously. But the mention of the cherubims here does invoke the Ark of the Covenant, but it's not really as strong as a reference as that phrase of God being exalted above all gods, which doesn't appear very frequently at all in the Bible. So not really as strong of a direct connection, and so again, I would just say the authorship is uncertain. We really just couldn't be confident about a particular writer for the psalm. There's no musical direction that is given in the text of this psalm, and there's no occasion given for the writing of this psalm. Now, when you read this psalm, it puts a scene before us, and the scene it puts before us is a future scene. This is a scene of something that has never happened in history, and it certainly aligns with specific prophecies of a future time, which we'll talk about a little more later. But as far as any occasion for the writing of the psalm, we don't have that. So to categorize this psalm, Psalm 99 is a praise psalm. So you do have the calls to praise and the reasons to praise, which are standard conventions in a praise psalm. It does have some other minor elements to it, like for one, the historical psalm. And I don't even know if I maybe have not mentioned that in a couple of the previous psalms, but the historical element. So you have, what's interesting in this psalm is that you have actually a blending of Israel's history in this psalm. So you've got allusion to the wilderness exile, but also the tabernacle and temple in the land of Israel. And it's just all kind of jumbled together, just like you have references to Moses and Aaron and the pillar of the cloud, and then you have reference to Samuel and the tabernacle. And so it's just all kind of blended together. And there's obviously a good reason for that. Also, it is a kingship, a messianic psalm. You see the reference to the king and to the Lord reigning in this psalm. We have reference to that reign. We have reference to God's holy heel and his footstool and all those sort of things. So a kingship and messianic psalm. It's also a prophetic predictive. Now, this one of the things that differs in this psalm from some of the previous ones we've just recently looked at is that this psalm doesn't use the future tense in it. Like the last psalm spoke about, you know, the Lord will come and shall judge the world. So you don't have that future tense in this psalm, but this psalm, again, it does envision a future scene, something when Yahweh is reigning over all of the earth from Zion, which, again, is something that has not occurred yet in history, though it is prophesied to take place. And so that's the scene that the psalm envisions. So for that reason, it is a prophetic psalm. It doesn't, as I said, the histories that it refers to are somewhat blended, and so there's not really a clear historical occasion or scene, but it is a future scene that has connections with those historical scenes. Speaking of the connections of the psalm, Psalm 99 connects with the previous psalms in Book 4. So we have these continued themes of Yahweh as king, and remember, as you come out of Book 3, Psalm 89 speaks of just the devastation. You have the Davidic line that has failed. Jerusalem and the temple is destroyed. The throne of David and the crown of David are in the dust, and there's none of his line to take the throne. Israel is not a nation with their own land, and that's sort of how Book 3 ends. And then Book 4 is an answer to that. And so we have all of this wilderness exile theme that has been going through these psalms. And the reason why is because that is a comparable time to the way that Israel has been since the destruction of Jerusalem. You had a small return for a time, but again, a scattering. Now we've seen a small return back to the land, partially at least in land. But still yet, they in the main remain in exile. Now, when they came out of Egypt, they're in exile in the actual wilderness, the desert wilderness. And now they're in exile in the wilderness of the nations. So they're scattered among all the nations all over the face of the earth. So that is a similar condition. So we get these themes of Yahweh as king. In other words, his universal kingship, his throne in the heavens has not been unseated from the throne because Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed. And you read a book like Lamentations and you get that very raw reaction to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Almost just unbelievable, just unable to process all the emotions of this and all that sort of thing in the book of Lamentations. So Yahweh continues as king, and his universal reign guarantees his reign from Zion. And that's the point of that theme. So we have themes of judgment and justice and wilderness exile and all that have continued throughout these psalms. The poetic features of Psalm 99 is probably the most prominent is that we have a structural feature. So there's a theme of God's holiness that runs through this psalm. And that theme of God's holiness is punctuated in this psalm in three places by a refrain. So his name is holy. We get that in verse 3. And that is preceded by a call to praise his great name. In verse 5, we get the statement that he is holy. And that's preceded by a call to worship him at his footstool. And then in verse 9, we get the psalm ending with that Yahweh, our Elohim, is holy in verse number 9, and that's preceded by a call to worship at his holy hill. So structurally, that would be that feature. We do have some repetition of holy and holiness and worship and judgment and righteousness and some of those sort of things. Okay, so let's work our way through this psalm. We have 9 verses here. Go ahead and read the psalm. The Lord reigneth. Let the people tremble. He sitteth between the cherubims. Let the earth be moved. The Lord is great in Zion, and he is high above all the people. Let them praise thy great and terrible name, for it is holy. The king's strength also loveth judgment. Thou dost establish equity. Thou executest judgment and righteousness in Jacob. Exalt ye the Lord our God, and worship at his footstool, for he is holy. Moses and Aaron among his priests, and Samuel among them that call upon his name. They called upon the Lord, and he answered them. He spake unto them in the cloudy pillar. They kept his testimonies and the ordinance that he gave them. Thou answerest them, O Lord our God. Thou wast a God that forgavest them, though thou tookest vengeance of their inventions. Exalt the Lord our God, and worship at his holy hill, for the Lord our God is holy. So verses 1 to 3 give us this opening call to praise. We read here how that the Lord reigns in holiness. And so each of these three parts that we're going to look at with these refrains, each of these three parts emphasize something about the Lord's reign. So the Lord reigns in holiness as this psalm opens. And the word for reigns that is used there, it's the verb form of the noun for king. So you have king that appears a little later in the psalm, and reigns or reigneth appears at the opening of this psalm. And again, it's the verb form of that word. So the verb form doesn't appear very often. We have it in Psalm 47 and verse 8, and then Psalm 93 and verse 1, Psalm 96 and verse 10, Psalm 97 and verse 1, and Psalm 99 and verse 1, and then Psalm 146 and verse 10. So basically, all those references are in book 4 except the one that's in Psalm 47 and then the one that is later in Psalm 146. So that's where the concentration is right here in this part of the psalm that we are in. And the use of this verb suggests the activity of reigning or the activity of taking a kingdom even. Now the word that's used for people here again is the plural amim. One of the common words that is used for nations. So I think some of the more recent translations actually translate this in the plural and say peoples. But nations is really the idea here. This word does occur a couple times in the psalm. Now the word for sitting, he sitteth between the cherubims. The word for sitting in this context refers to enthronement. And it can refer to it typically refers to not just sitting down, but the idea of abiding, dwelling, that there's a continuance. And it can refer to sitting in judgment, to sitting in reign. And so in this context, it is a reference to enthronement. And we have this word used to speak of enthronement a few times in the Psalms. So in Psalm 2 and verse number 4, the Lord sits in the heavens. So this is his enthronement in the heavens. In Psalm 9, verses 4 and 11, we read of his sitting in his throne of judgment. Psalm 29 and verse 10, he's enthroned on the flood. Psalm 33 and verse 14, he is enthroned above. Psalm 47 and verse 8, he's enthroned over the nations. And in Psalm 80 and verse 1, he's enthroned between the cherubim, just like the reference is here in verse 1 of Psalm 99. Now, this reference to between the cherubim is actually a reference to the tabernacle and later to the temple and the Ark of the Covenant, where the Shekinah glory dwelt between the cherubim. It was the manifestation of God's presence in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And here he is enthroned or he is sitting between the cherubim, which again speaks of his reign and of his presence. And as we go on reading, this is again envisioning the presence of Yahweh in Zion. And so we'll see that come out a little while later. Now the result of Yahweh's reign is that the nations tremble and the earth shakes. And so this moving or this quaking at the presence of the Lord is what is being referred to. This earth being moved, the word for earth there is the habitable land of the earth that's referred to. We have reference to the foundation of the hills being shaken at his presence in Psalm 18 and verse 7. The depths of the seas being shaken at his presence, Psalm 77 and verse 16. And again, a reference to the habitable land of the earth being shaken at his presence in Psalm 77 and verse number 18. Now, the call to praise that we see there in verse number 3, the call to praise and this refrain that the Lord's name is holy. It says that he is great in, or his name is great and terrible, rather, and great refers to magnitude or to extent. Terrible would convey the idea of frightening, of fear and terror. Now, that his name is holy means that his name is separate. His name is unlike any other name. Another way to put that would be that it is above all other names. His name is holy, and that is the refrain that ends that section. In the next section, in verses 4 to 5, where we see he reigns in justice. So his reign is holy, and his reign is just, and his, or you could say his justice is holy, what we see in verses 4 to 5. Now, what we have here in verse 4 is not just that he reigns in judgment, but we're actually told that he loves judgment. He loves judgment. And the word for judgment, it indicates a verdict. It's a decision. It's judgment in that sense. And that his judgment is obviously righteous and upright and equitable, what we see in these phrases. And the word for equity there that's used is a word that means evenness. So there's we might say impartial judgment. There's an evenness of the judgment that's not biased, it's not prejudiced. It can't be bribery. There can't be bribery and perversion of justice by those that may be wealthy and powerful on the earth. It is equitable. It is across the board. It is fair judgment. But it also refers to the king's strength, which is an unusual phrase, that he's a mighty king. He is a powerful king. And in this case, though, we see that his strength, his power, is used in holiness. His power is used in righteousness. His power is used in justice. His power is used in judgment. In other words, his strength is for absolute good. So obviously one of the terrible things about a corrupt leader is when they have and use power for corruption and perversion. In fact, one of the things that is even somewhat of a relief, if there is a corrupt leader in power, if for some reason they're weak, whatever the case may be, and if they're unable to do what they would really like to do, which would corrupt their authority and their rule even more. Well, we don't have that with the king when he comes to Zion, because his power, he loves judgment, he loves righteousness, he loves holiness. Now, the reference to Jacob here is a reference to Israel as a nation. And so what we're getting is God's actions historically concerning Israel display these attributes and testify to their truth, that God is holy, that God is just, that God is righteous, that God is equitable. But this also means then, if we think about God's actions historically that have been righteous and just and holy in regards to Israel, then that also means that he must in the future act in power and holiness and judgment and justice to Israel to fulfill all that he has promised to them, which is going to include both their sifting as a nation that brings judgment on the unbelieving among them, and their redemption as a nation that extends his mercy to those who are converted to their Messiah. And then we have this call to praise that ends this section that lift up the king because he is holy. And this footstool reference is another reference to the tabernacle, to the temple, to the Ark of the Covenant. And we get that reference particularly stated by David in 1 Chronicles chapter 28 and verse number 2 in reference to his footstool and the temple and all that. And then we go to the last section, which is verses 6 to 9, where we see that he reigns in grace. So we get Moses and Aaron named, and then Samuel added. And as we say, when you look at the historical references that are just run throughout this psalm, but it's not just one particular reference. It's almost sort of like it's compressing or sort of mashing together Israel's history in these references, blending them together. So we get Moses and Aaron and Samuel, which are at very different times of Israel's history. But what we have here is we have reference to prophets and priests that interceded for the people to God and spoke to the people for God. Now, this took place in Israel's history. Now, this reference to calling on the name of the Lord, now, this is a reference that we've seen as we've worked our way through the Psalms. This is one of those references that gets repeated. And calling on the name of the Lord is a covenantal reference. When we get this, that they called and that the Lord answered So the Lord answers those who take refuge in him. He hears them. He delivers them. And we see that a lot showing up in the laments. Now, we're not in lament psalms currently, but we see that a lot in the laments that we have looked at, this idea of calling out and the Lord hearing. And it is because the righteous are suffering. But again, because they've taken refuge in him, they are in covenant relationship with him. This reference to the cloudy pillar alludes to the wilderness. We have reference that the covenant faithful kept his testimonies and his ordinances. In other words, they didn't rebel against his word like the generation that died in the wilderness. So God's covenant faithfulness is evidenced in answering and forgiving those that called on him. So he also punished his wrongs, and we see that coming out there in verse number 8. He answered them, he forgave them. But he also took vengeance on their inventions, or you might say their wrongdoings. So he punished their wrongdoings. So to the rebellious among Israel, he punished them by cutting them off from the inheritance of life and land, even though they were descendants of Jacob. To the faithful, he punished their wrongs by chastening them. And we could point to different episodes in the life of Moses as well as in the life of Aaron, where we see those kind of chastenings that came about because of their wrongdoings. And then in the ending, we have a call to exalt, to lift up the Lord. His holy hill is a reference to Zion or the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The implication being that they should bow to him there as he sits there enthroned. And that word for worship that's used a couple times in the psalm, it does mean to bow down before. And then the ending refrain that the Lord our God is holy. All right, so let's go to interpretation. Well, Psalm 99 obviously teaches something about the holiness of God. That is a dominant theme in this particular psalm. Now, holiness means separate. So it's separate from evil, separate from sin, separate from wrongdoing, separate from all earthly powers, separate, entirely, we might say entirely unique. That God is God alone, that God is holy. It means that he is like none other. He is unlike all others. And what that means is that Father, Son, and Spirit are holy. Now, holiness then means perfection in or perfect righteousness in judgment and in punishment. And that actually explains why that God can forgive. Because that's an interesting reference that you get in this psalm. Because we've had a number of psalms that we've looked at in book 4 in particular that speak about his coming and speak about judgment or speak about the joy of the faithful. But here we get references to God forgiving. So if we think back to Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 and 7, and the Lord passed by before him and proclaimed the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and to the fourth generation. So we see that when we think back to these statements about Israel in the wilderness and Moses and Aaron and then even Samuel and the case of King Saul and of Israel later. So what we learn then is that God's judgments as well as his grace are holy. Now, this reference that we get here to his priests, well, this also would allude to sacrifice and to atonement, to make reconciliation between God and his covenant faithful. And of course, this is why God forgives, because atonement, reconciliation is made. Of course, we know that today comes through the sacrifice, not of bulls and goats and such, but through his son, Jesus Christ, once for all. Well, Psalm 99 also teaches that the praise of and worship of Yahweh is only in truth. And this might seem a little bit of a subtle point, But it is something to keep in mind, and we've seen this, we've encountered this sort of thing in a psalm before, and we'll see it as we go on. But I just want to draw attention to it. So we have reference here to praising Yahweh, to praising, in verse 3, let them praise thy great and terrible name, for it is holy. We also have references to them keeping the testimonies and the ordinances. In other words, that means doing what God has said to do. Well, the command to praise his name exposes the silly sort of superstitions of those who would not, or even continuing today, will not speak or write the name of God unless they take it in vain. So think about that. So there are those who will not write the name of God, they will not speak the name of God, because, well, you know, we don't want to take the name of God in vain. Now, this is a tradition that has very, very ancient roots and continues among some different groups even today. But God, we are specifically commanded to praise his name. And we are told his name for the purpose of knowing him and who he is and praising him. So it just exposes that adding silly traditions like that do not equal greater reverence for God. You can't be more reverent toward God than what God has told you to be. So if this is what God has told us to do, we can't be more reverent toward God by not doing it. You know, well, praise his blank. Well, we can't be more reverent than what God has commanded. So we are called to praise his name. So what you end up with those sort of traditions, which is really what happens with legalism, and exactly what Jesus explained to the Pharisees, you've actually made void the commandments of God because you're following these traditions that are an effort and an attempt to be more holy, an effort and an attempt to be more reverent, but what they end up doing is actually disobeying what God has told us to do. And so, again, that would be an example, just such a thing. Oh, we cannot speak the name of God because we might be taking it in vain. So we don't want to violate that. So we don't want to speak the name of God. Well, then in turn, that means that you're going to directly disobey the commandments that say, praise his great and terrible name. We are to acknowledge his name. We are to praise his name. So again, that's something of a minor and a subtle point, but it's come up a few times in the Psalms, and just thought it would be a good place to point that out. Now, the messianic hope in Psalm 99 is seen through this future scene that envisions the holy king reigning in holiness and righteousness over all the nations of the earth from Mount Zion. And again, this is a scene that has not yet taken place. This has not occurred in history yet, but it will. And again, there are specific prophecies about this very thing. But think about some of the things that this psalm brings out. The mighty king in verse 4, we're told, loves judgment. It's not just that he reigns, that his reign is just. It's not just that he reigns in righteousness. It's not just that he has equity toward all, but he loves it. Well, this also echoes forward from Psalm 1 and 2, which give us this picture of the ideal king, as it were. And so we have other places that speak of him loving justice. So Psalm 45, verses 6 and 7, again, a very messianic psalm. Psalm 72, verses 1 to 4 and 12 to 14, another messianic psalm speaking particularly of the Messiah. So again, it's not just that he acts in righteousness or that he reigns in righteousness, but he loves it. He loves righteousness. He loves the holiness. He loves holiness. So we also have reference to Moses and Aaron and Samuel, which is somewhat obviously a unique reference in the psalm. And so what you get there are prophets and priests and intercessors for Israel. But then we're told that they were forgiven, their wrongs were punished. Now, this didn't mean just Moses and Aaron and Samuel in particular, but of Israel, during the times of their intercession. But what that means is, though, that they had to have a prophet, a priest, and an intercessor that needed no forgiveness. In other words, they need a greater prophet, they need a greater priest, they need a greater intercessor than what Moses and Aaron and Samuel were. Well, that's the implication of this psalm is that Yahweh is the prophet, the priest, and the intercessor. And that's going to become explicit as we get to Psalm 110, but that is a few psalms down the road. This psalm also envisions this scene where the nations of the earth are streaming to Zion, to Jerusalem, to worship or to bow down, as the word indicates, to the king. All right, so this scene is a fulfillment of prophecies in Isaiah chapter 45, verses 22 to 23. Look unto me and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none else. I have sworn by myself, the word has gone out of my mouth in righteousness and shall not return, that unto me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear. And so how is this to be fulfilled? Well, Paul answers that question in Philippians chapter 2, verses 9 to 11, speaking of Jesus Christ. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name. What is a name that's above every name? It is a holy name. That at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So again, Psalm 99 is envisioning this future scene when Yahweh reigns from Zion. And of course, Psalm 2, of course, tells us that his son, his anointed son, will be installed as king on the holy hill of Zion. Okay, applications. I have three of these. So number one, understanding Psalm 99 helps us understand that the worship of God must be in truth. Not just at that future time, but in history, in the present, and in the time future to us, up to his coming and beyond. At all times, God must be worshiped in truth. So many people today worship a God that is a God of their own imagination. And suspiciously, that God acts and thinks a lot like they do. That God that they claim to worship, and when you listen to the things that they say and so on, and you listen to the things that people say about Jesus. And I heard a good illustration the other day. If you ran into someone, out on the street or something, and they claimed to know your mother, and they began to describe your mother in all sorts of terrible ways that were nothing like your mother, I imagine that, we would all be a little bit offended by that, and we would want to set the record straight. I don't know who you're talking about, but that's certainly not my mother that you're talking about. My mother is not this, this, and this. My mother is this, this, and this. Well, how many people that we hear, we see on social media and we hear in all kinds of different ways, people talking about God and talking about Jesus in all sorts of ways that are contradictory to what he has revealed of himself in the Bible. So the true worship of God, it doesn't matter how excited that someone is, it doesn't matter how emotional that someone is, it doesn't matter what they felt or what they think they've experienced, the worship of God must be in truth. This is who he is. He is holy. He is righteous. He is just. At his coming and at his presence, the entire earth shakes, and all of the nations will tremble, and they will fall. Every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess. Why? Because he is the king of power. So there's mercy with God, but he's not to be trifled with. He's perfectly holy and perfectly just. We must worship him in truth. Number two, Psalm 99 helps us understand how that the world will be made right. And obviously this is a message that speaks even to Israel in exile today. It's a message that speaks to us today, even us of the nations of the world today. It's the return of the king to Zion that will establish equitable, righteous, holy justice on the earth. So what is right and fair and good will prevail over the entire earth in his kingdom, but not before. Number three, Psalm 99, understanding Psalm 99 helps us understand how to look at history for hope for the future. So we oftentimes talk about the clarity of hindsight, how we can look back. And sometimes we'll talk about how that, or we might remember how that we're going through some circumstance. We can't understand, we can't figure, you know, what's God doing? How is this going to be good? How is this going to turn out? And then later, not always, but a lot of times later, we can look back and we can see God was working in miraculous ways there that I didn't even conceive of at the time. I didn't even comprehend it at the time, but I can see that, and I'm sure I still can't even see everything. So we know that we get some clarity when we look backward at things, and so we have references like this in this psalm that's bidding us look back to some of these histories and how that God has acted. Think about who he is and think about what he has promised that is still yet to be fulfilled. So we learn how to look back to history, whether it's our own personal history and looking back into the history of others in the Christian faith throughout history, looking back certainly to these histories that we have in the Bible. And so we understand how to have that hope for the future in understanding a psalm like this and how it bids us to look back and forward.